by, and hooligans rampaged through the streets. In particular, they preyed on our people walking alone in isolated areas or at night. A new level of tension crept into our own household, nearly overwhelming me. I found it difficult to study, difficult to concentrate. Some days, it was as though someone had put me in Grandma's cake mixer, but I was struggling to be still, not to spin or shudder or shake. During those rare moments when I sat alone in my room among my stuffed animals, I daydreamed about Vince and what it would be like to be his ordinary girlfriend and have real dates. I had finally gathered the nerve to ask Mother and Grandma for permission to date. After giving me what amounted to a thorough exam with really hard questions about Vince's intentions and character, Mother Lois said, "Have him come to the house." Her expression saddened as she went on. "Now understand, this is not really dating, and you can only see this boy in the presence of another adult. I'm allowing you to do this because integration has taken away so much of your social life." I had a hard time containing my hallelujah shouts as I started to leave the room. But just as I reached the door, she said, "Of course! You'll wait to exercise this privilege until after the court hearing tomorrow." On the night before the hearing, I took Grandma's advice and let God worry about what was going to happen in that courtroom. I wrote in my diary, "Dear God, we can't get along without you. Governor Faubus has lots of attorneys, and the paper says they have more than 200 witnesses. I'm counting on you once and for all to make it clear whether you want me in that school. Thy will be done." 9. Faubus, U.S. government, head into crucial collision in federal court today. Arkansas Gazette, Friday, September 20th, 1957. The first clash between the federal government and a state over school integration will reach a crucial stage at 10 a.m. today in Federal District Court at Little Rock. The immediate issue will be whether Governor Faubus and the Arkansas National Guard should be enjoined from further interference with integration at Little Rock Central High School. The overriding historic issue will be whether the federal government has the constitutional authority to check a state governor when he uses the powers of his office to defy the federal court. Sitting alone in my room, I couldn't stop thinking how Governor Faubus would for certain have to be in that courtroom. I couldn't imagine that he wouldn't be there. In my diary, I wrote, "This is the day I hope to meet Governor Faubus face to face. I can't decide what to say to him. If only he will listen to me 1 minute, I know I can make him understand there is nothing so bad about me that he shouldn't allow white children to go to school with me." The weatherman says it's going to be 85 and up this afternoon. I'll regret wearing my cotton blouse and quilted skirt, but they're new and pretty. I want to look just right, so the governor will know who I really am. The nine of us walked up the sidewalk toward the federal building at a brisk pace. Our group included Mrs. Bates, attorneys Thurgood Marshall and Wally Branton, and a number of people I did not know. I was told they were community ministers and lawyers coming along to protect us. Between awkward scraps of conversation, I could hear our footsteps on the sidewalk as we moved toward the official-looking building. I had never paid much attention to it before. It was a muggy day, rather like the inside of a steam room. As we grew closer to our destination, there were more people and more chatter, but my mind was flooded with important things I wanted to say to the governor. One voice inside me said he didn't care what I thought, but the other said I should be prepared just in case. I was a bit on edge. A small part of me was becoming accustomed to the fact that, since the integration had begun, both my people and whites stared at me. Some of the faces lining the streets on that morning had welcome smiles. Others were indifferent, while still others were undeniably angry. I wore dark glasses, which allowed me to peer out wherever I wanted without anybody being able to see how fearful I was. I had never been in court before. I'd only seen pictures of judges. I felt frightened. Frightened of the federal court, but mostly frightened of all those powerful government men, the governor's lawyers who could make things happen just as they wanted. I had read in the newspaper that attorneys for the federal government would be arguing that there was no evidence of the kind of violence that made it necessary to call out troops. Since the governor claimed our going to Central was what caused the trouble, we nine students were subpoenaed to tell what we had seen and experienced on that first day at Central High School. I was afraid of what would happen if we lost. Would that mean we couldn't be sued or arrested? Would the news reporters make fun of us? What would my friend say?
"We're gonna have to take the kids in through the side door,"
a man's voice said. My pace quickened as we were ushered past all the people milling about through a very narrow, dimly lit marble hall where our voices and footsteps echoed. We were led to the elevator, walking fast as if we were being chased. The door slid shut, and I stared straight ahead. My knees were trembling, and every inch of my body was perspiring. That elevator was so full that I could hear its guts grinding as it struggled to deliver us to the fourth-floor courtroom. I hoped the opening elevator doors would admit fresh air. Instead, they revealed a crush of people, jammed body to body, shoving each other, desperately trying to get through that narrow hallway to go somewhere or do something. I was blinded by the glaring lights held high over the heads of the sea of people by news photographers trying to get pictures. We could hardly get out of the elevator and into the throng. Like sardines, we wiggled and pushed, trying to forge a pathway. I stopped thinking about fresh, cool air. I just wanted to breathe and not be crushed. As we emerged, several reporters started shouting questions at us. I felt as though I were attending one of those Hollywood openings I'd seen on TV.
"What do you think of Governor Faubus?
How do you think the white students will treat you if you go back to Central?
Why do you want to go to the white school?
Are your parents buying knives and guns?"
"No,"
I shouted.
"Nobody's buying weapons."
Mrs. Bates touched my shoulder.
"Shh,"
she said. We had been cautioned not to talk back to reporters on this day. We were to say nothing until after the NAACP attorneys had made our case. Flashing cameras and blinding lights followed as we inched our way through the corridor. The questions continued, rapid fire, close in our faces. Perspiration trickled down the back of my neck. I could see beads of water on the noses and foreheads of many people crowded around me.
"Smile, kids," Mrs. Bates whispered. "Straighten your shoulders. Stand tall."
It felt as though there were about 100 people in that hallway, where only half that many should have been squeezed in. Cameramen were perched on chairs and even on each other to get pictures. They must have been real anxious to be there, because they were undoubtedly suffering in the sweltering heat and risking bodily injury as well.
"Melba, we're inside now. Take off those dark glasses, please."
I was embarrassed to be singled out that way by Mrs. Bates. The glare of the light hurt my eyes, and I didn't really want to look into the faces of all those people who seemed to be staring at me.
"Some of you all think we're stars, but really, all these reporters are here to see if we're going to get killed or not,"
teased one of the comics from our group. Step by step, with enormous effort, we managed to get through the crush of human bodies. The courtroom was smaller than I'd imagined, about the size of an average living room, with wooden benches lining either side of a narrow aisle.
I had heard someone say the courtroom only held 150 people. It was filled to overflowing. I was glad to see that a good number of the spectators were our people. Sections of the room were roped off. We were squeezed through the crowd and ushered to one of the areas in front, near the bailiff. Reporters holding their notebooks sat in the jury box and in a small section at the rear of the room. As we took our seats, I noticed the United States and Arkansas's flags displayed in the front of the room.
"Niggers stink. The room smells now,"
a voice called out from somewhere behind us. I turned around to see three white ladies directly behind me.
"I'll bet you don't even know your ABCs, monkeys,"
one of them said.
"You monkeys? What are you looking at?"
I glowered at her, trying not to say what I was really thinking. Where I came from, adults didn't behave that way. Suddenly, uniformed soldiers were arriving. I turned my attention away from the woman heckling me as the soldiers paraded down the aisle with military precision. So, these were the armed men who were keeping us away from school. These were the leaders of the Arkansas National Guard. Up close, they seemed much less intimidating. Some of them were no taller than I was. Several men and one woman, all wearing business suits and carrying briefcases, were talking to the uniformed men. I figured they were the governor's attorneys. I asked where the governor was, expecting him any moment. That's when one of the attorneys told us that an elected official does not have to appear to answer a summons. Maybe I would not have the privilege of seeing the governor after all. I had hoped that seeing him in person would help me get over my dislike for him. Suddenly, a whisper of concern made its way through our group. We were all aware that Thelma Mothershed had a heart condition, and now, right before our eyes, her lips and fingertips were turning blue. She struggled to catch her breath. All of us focused our attention on her, and instantly I knew it was a mistake. Not only might it alarm her, but our behavior could also alert school officials to her failing health. I assumed they had never bothered to check her school records. Otherwise, they might have stopped her going to the integration.
"Shh. Thelma will be just fine. Sit up straight. Think about what you'll say if you're called to testify."
Mrs. Bates relieved our tension as she moved to sit beside Thelma.
"All rise. The Honorable Judge Ronald Davies presiding."
The deep voice sounded like a circus ringmaster announcing the next act. I held my breath. I had read so much about him. What would he be like? A very small man wearing a black robe entered and moved swiftly toward the massive desk. His smooth, dark hair was parted in the middle, framing his pleasant, round face. As he climbed up to the imposing leather chair and settled in, what stood out most of all were his huge eyes peering through thick, horn-rimmed glasses. From where I sat, I could see only the top part of his black robe, his round face, and those all-seeing, all-knowing eyes. Shortly after the hearing began, one of the governor's attorneys, Tom Harper, stood and made a motion that Judge Davies disqualify himself because he was biased due to his appointment by the federal government specifically for our case. Judge Davies pounded his gavel and ruled the motion for disqualification was not legally sufficient and not timely. Next, Wiley Branton asked the court's permission to file a supplementary complaint joining us in the government's petition against Farbus and two Arkansas National Guard commanders. Davies ruled it could be filed. The governor's attorney, Tom Harper, then asked to have subpoenas withdrawn that had been served on Arkansas National Guard commander Adjutant General Klinger and his assistant, saying men on military duty are exempt from subpoenas. Again, the judge ruled against them. Meanwhile, there was a commotion at the rear of the room as reporters hustled back and forth, scribbling on notepads and whispering to each other. They behaved as though they had some divine right to do whatever was necessary to get the information they needed. They were an electrifying show unto themselves, separate and apart from the judge and lawyers. The more I watched them, the more I thought I'd like to become one when I grew up. As a reporter, I would get to observe interesting events and write about them. I'd also get to behave with a know-it-all urgency, as though what I was doing were more important than anything else. The seats were so hard that I was pleased Judge Davies moved things along swiftly, pounding his gavel, denying motions presented by the governor's attorneys, all the while speaking sternly. Finally, just before noon, Harper, once again speaking for Governor Faubus, asked if preliminary matters were taken care of. "Well," the judge growled, "I haven't gotten the late mail, but I think so." Continuing in a matter-of-fact tone, Harper then asked Judge Davies to dismiss the case because it involved constitutional issues that required a 3-judge panel. Judge Davies ruled that the case would continue. In response to that ruling, Harper said, "May we be excused?" Judge Davies spoke emphatically. "You are excused, gentlemen, but you understand that this is a moot question. The hearing will proceed." Continuing to speak for all the governor's attorneys, Harper began reading a statement. "The position of Governor Faubus and the military officials of the state is that the governor and the state will not concede that the U.S. court or anyone else can question the authority of the governor to exercise his judgment in administering the affairs of state. And since he does not concede this responsibility, we will not proceed further in this action." To my amazement, Harper led the way as several men and one woman gathered their papers and followed him out the door. "Is this a protest?" someone asked. Reporters ran for the door like corralled horses through an open gate. I thought they'd hurt themselves. The judge pounded the gavel. The attorneys for the Department of Justice called themselves amicus curiae, saying they were prepared to offer more than 100 witnesses to support the order for integration. Word was whispered down our line that amicus curiae meant friend of the court. But surely no real friend would keep us sitting on those hard seats long enough for 100 people to testify. My heart sank as we 9 eyeballed each other with grim expressions. "We'll be too old for high school if we have to listen to all those people," I whispered aloud. To my delight, the judge announced the 100 witnesses would not begin until after recess. In order to get to our lunch, we walked through a gauntlet of hot flashing lights and squeezed past people shouting questions. Once outside, we encountered the problem that had always plagued our people in Little Rock. There were no restaurants that would serve us, at least no decent ones. The mighty Thurgood Marshall was forced to join us in a greasy joint that served wilted lettuce on overcooked hamburgers in the shabby section of our neighborhood known as 9th Street. As he ate, he answered our questions. More than anything, he seemed to be astonished that the governor's attorneys had walked out of the room so suddenly. "It must have been their plan all along," he said. That afternoon, the parade of witnesses presented by the Justice Department made one major point. They said the threat of violence due to integration was not sufficient for the governor to have called out troops. The mayor of Little Rock, the chairman of the school board, the superintendent of schools, the principal of Central High, and the Little Rock chief of police all testified that they found no threat of violence in Little Rock and had not requested that the governor send troops. School superintendent Virgil Blossom testified for a long time about the details of the school board's plan for integration, which had taken 2 years and 200 meetings to devise. U.S. District Attorney Orso Cobb asked how many complaints he had gotten.
Blossom said the school board had received only a few complaints and suggestions for improving the plan.
As a matter of fact, the plan has been very well received. I'm not saying I believe any majority of the people of Little Rock want integration, he said. They don't. But they favor this plan as the best answer to a difficult problem.
The judge asked the superintendent a question many people had asked me, and one I had wondered about myself.
How were these 9 students chosen?
The Negroes were selected on the basis of scholarship, personal conduct, and health. We picked those who had the mental ability to do the job and had used it, Blossom answered.
For just a moment, I fretted they would discover Thelma's secret heart problem, but the fact was they had never had us examined by a doctor, and there was no talk of doing so. Then it was time to present our case. The nagging voice inside my head said, how could I put my hand on the Bible and not tell the whole truth? Another voice argued that, yes, Mother and I were chased, but in fact, we weren't hurt. They didn't really touch us. So the truth was, we weren't injured on that day. Over and over again, it had been explained to me that to say we were physically injured or attacked that first day on the school grounds or in the immediate area would be to support the governor's case. We knew he would use the slightest justification to delay integration for all eternity. First to testify from our group was Ernest Green. He wanted to go to Central, he said, because it was closer to his home and would save time and money. He was asked whether he offered any assault against the troops.
No, sir, I didn't,
he said with a broad smile. Next, Elizabeth Eckford testified. She did not complain about the life-threatening mob that had traumatized her. She sat erect, speaking calmly, saying that a few white people lived not far from her house, yet there had been no racial disputes. I was relieved when the attorney said that there would be no need for the rest of us to testify. Had I been asked to place my hand on the Bible, I don't know what I might have been forced to say, perhaps truths that would have hurt us. I figured it was that divine force again, moving us on to integration. The attorneys for the United States made repeated references to the May 1954 decision. I had to stop listening. The very mention of that decision always made me sad. It brought back the face of the angry white man who had chased me down that day. Panic-filled recollections flooded my mind, blotting out the courtroom proceedings.
Melba! Melba!
Minnie Jean was tugging at my arm. The others were excited. The judge was announcing his decision, saying that the governor had thwarted the court-approved plan of integration by means of National Guard troops. The judge's voice was deep, his tone emphatic, as he said,
there is no real evidence here that we shouldn't proceed with the court-ordered integration of Central High School. The order is so entered.
He pounded the gavel, stood, and walked out of the room.
Oh, damn nigger-loving judge,
someone shouted, using all those words that Grandma said would lead a body to hell. Mrs. Bates told us to remain seated until everyone else left the room. I sat very still for a long moment as everybody around me began moving. So, God, you really do want me to go back to that school? For a time, it seemed as if I were all alone in a silent tunnel, and everyone else was way at the other end. I would always remember that judge and his huge, piercing, dark eyes. There must be something wonderful in his heart, I thought. I would remember him in my prayers. As a throng of reporters surged toward us, my heart was pounding, my breath coming in short spurts. I flashed my confident smile, but my knees wobbled. Those reporters went crazy, all shoving and shouting their questions at once. I thought they might injure us and themselves as they climbed over each other and tried to get their cameras into position.
It was like nothing I had ever experienced before.
Come Monday morning, you'll be a genuine Central High student. How do you feel about that?
One reporter shouted his questions above all others. Monday morning, I whispered, I'm gonna be a Central High student. Monday morning. At 6:20 p.m. Friday evening, Governor Faubus made a big deal of removing the Arkansas National Guard from Central High. He appeared on television saying that he would appeal Judge Davies' ruling. He gave a long and impassioned speech, predicting once again that if integration took place, blood would run in the streets of Little Rock.
You know he's smart like a fox, Grandma said. He's got something in mind, suddenly moving those troops that way.
No, I think he's just following the judge's orders. Anyhow, he's a defeated man. Let's celebrate. Mother raised her glass of lemonade. Grandma frowned. She disliked any one of us to do with milk or a cola what sinners did with liquor. To integration with peace and joy and harmony, Mother said, smiling, and took a sip of her lemonade.
All right, Grandma said, lifting an imaginary glass into the air. To life, without all this ugliness. Maybe now things will quiet down and get back to normal.
That night, I wrote in my diary,
Okay, God, so Grandma is right. It's my turn to carry the banner.
Please help me do thy will. Over the weekend, Little Rock became an eerie city. Only those with urgent business walked the streets with quick, nervous strides. People from my community did not gather and visit as they usually would. Like me, they must have been frightened by the news reports that continued to describe roving gangs of segregationists crisscrossing the city, looking to do harm to any of our people they could find. Rumors persisted that various people we knew had been beaten or chased. It felt awful not to have authorities to turn to in the midst of all the violence. I could see fear in the faces of the adults around me. I could hear it in their whispered conversations. All my life, I had felt unprotected by city officials. If some major crisis took place, like a fire in our community, white firemen had always taken their time coming to help. They didn't fight to save our lives and property, as if neither had any value to them, so we had set up our own systems of summoning each other for help. The integration dispute made me feel as though we were much more vulnerable. Whites had control of the police, the firemen, and the ambulances. They could decide who got help and who didn't. Even if the Ku Klux Klan ravaged one of our homes, we wouldn't call the police for help. None of us were certain which of our city officials wore civic uniforms by day and white sheets at night. News reports described Governor Faubus as unruffled by all the turmoil. He was living his life and doing business as usual in the face of this crisis. One article said that through the two previous hectic weeks, the governor had been sleeping soundly, eating regularly, chatting with his son in college, enjoying his fan mail, and relaxing as he read about his favorite president, Abraham Lincoln. He didn't sound to me like a man who was remorseful or planning to mend his ways, or a man who was suffering the inconvenience of having his normal way of life shattered, as we were. On Sunday, I thought the news of more violence in the streets might cause Grandma and Mama to forget about church. I should have known better. It was cloudy, with thunderstorms expected, as we cautiously drove our regular route to church. It upset us to see that sidewalks, usually filled with families on their way to Sunday service, were empty. We heard the church bells toll, their echoing clang a protest to the silence that blanketed our community. However, a hopeful mood was evident in the church service. The judge's positive decision for integration was God's will,
Reverend Young said, and God would give us the strength to go forth. He said we needed to pray and work to heal our divided community. He spoke of the many God-fearing, reasonable white people who supported our activities and of the white ministers joining forces to help stop the violence. He expressed gratitude and prayed for Mayor Woodrow Mann, who continued to defy Governor Faubus, accusing him of being wrong in opposing integration and the federal government. Our minister urged support for the nine of us who were integrating Central, mentioning the three of us who sat in church, Gloria, Ernie, and me. Mumbles of, "Yes, Lord," and "Amen," made me hope some people had changed their minds and that now most of my church family thought that I was doing the right thing. But nevertheless, there were those who disagreed and were willing to show their feelings at every turn. One woman snagged me in the ladies' bathroom, saying, "The nice white lady I worked for treated me like family up till now. These days, she treats me like I'm just the colored help." "Look," Mother said, "there's a price to be paid for freedom. We pay it now, or we're in ball and chain forever." "Easy for you to talk, Mrs. Petillo. You're an educated woman. I ain't got no sheepskin on my wall." The church service seemed to last longer than usual. Afterward, there was so much talk of integration that I felt wrung out. The only bright spot in my Sunday was Vince's offer to drive me home from church. Mother frowned at the suggestion. When I pleaded, she demanded that she trail us in her car. So we formed a two-car caravan, Vince in his brand-new square back red and white Chevy, and Grandma, Mama, and Conrad following close behind in our car. "I guess I better not speed," he said, grinning that handsome smile. I was craning my neck to look back every now and then. "Yep, there, he said. I was embarrassed that Mother was following us so closely. To make things worse, Vince had one thing on his mind, integration, finding out about what we nine were doing, when we got together, how we studied, and what the NAACP said to us in meetings. I began feeling as though I were giving a news report. "How does it feel to see your name in the paper, to be a celebrity that everybody's talking about?" I glanced at him in his Eisenhower jacket and slick shoes. He was sharp and wonderful. Why couldn't it be another place and time? "Uncomfortable," I grumbled. "Hey, there's got to be some good things in all the fuss they're making over you." "It's all so new that I can't figure it out yet. Right now, I'd give anything for just one day of normal school with old friends." "Too late for that. You're a Central High student." I had counted on our date as one last opportunity to feel normal joy before Monday came. Our conversation and his cute charms were supposed to stoke my daydreams so I'd have something to smile about when things went wrong at Central. No such luck. In less than 24 hours, I would face my first day inside Central High without this protective veil. 10. City and state police to be there today. Officials confident. Faubus says he's hoping for no unrest. U.S. keeping close eye on Little Rock. Arkansas Gazette, Monday, September 23rd, 1957. As I read the morning newspaper that Monday, what with all the changes, I thought maybe the headline would read, "Integration Halted Again." At least this time, it seemed everybody was expecting us to arrive at Central High School and go inside for classes. As I walked back to the kitchen, I decided I would begin to mark off my days at Central High on the big wall calendar that belonged to Grandma. I longed to see all the cross marks fill the days that would become weeks and then months. I glanced at the month of September and picked the spot where I would put the first cross mark, if I completed the first day. "Lord, please let me be strong enough to fill in this day.
and all the school days that follow. I whispered. It was not yet 8 o'clock when Mama and I parked at the curb, just outside Mrs. Bates' home. I was surprised to see so many people milling about the yard. There was double the usual throng of news reporters. Everybody spoke in whispers. We greeted each other as though there were a compelling reason not to talk in ordinary tones. I was ushered through the crowd and into the living room, where radio and news reports held everyone's attention. Hundreds are gathered at Central High to await the arrival of 9 Negro students who will begin the court-ordered integration. Some believe the governor should have instructed the soldiers to remain at the school to keep order. Assistant Police Chief Gene Smith and a group of officers arrived at 7 a.m. to patrol the area. 50 state police have joined them. We 9 acknowledged each other with nervous smiles and a very few whispered words. Adults nodded to each other with the kind of glances that seemed to carry secret messages as they periodically looked at their watches. The nervousness grew worse with each passing moment. People were pacing, pretending to smile, sitting a moment, then rising to pace again. After a while, I became one of those people. We were going to be late for school, no doubt, late on the first day. What would everybody think? The phone rang. It was time to be on our way. Mother Lois looked as though she were on the brink of tears. As we filed silently out of the house, I waved goodbye to her. I wanted to hug her, but I didn't want everyone to think I was a baby. Other parents milled about, looking as if we were being carted off to be hanged. As we started to walk to the cars, they clutched at us as though they weren't completely certain we'd be coming back. We settled ourselves into 2 cars. Mrs. Bates was in the first car with 4 of the 9 and a man introduced as C.C. Mercer. Another NAACP official, Frank Smith, was driving the car I rode in with the remaining 4 students. We watched the news reporters run to their vehicles and rev their engines. The non-white reporters seemed hesitant about getting started. They hovered together. That's when I realized it must be difficult, even dangerous, for our people to cover a story like this. We seemed at first to be driving in circles. Our driver explained that the police advised we not take the usual route because segregationists might lie in wait for us. I looked at my watch. It was after 8:30. We'd be very late arriving, even later than I had feared. Central High was located on Park Street, stretching a 2-block distance between 14th and 16th Streets. But the route we took confused my sense of direction. I was surprised when suddenly we pulled up to the side entrance at 16th Street, just beyond Park. Amid noise and confusion, the driver urged us to get out quickly. The white hand of a uniformed officer reached out toward the car, opening the door and pulling me toward him as his urgent voice ordered us to hurry. The roar coming from the front of the building made me glance to my right. Only a half block away, I saw hundreds of white people, their bodies in motion, their mouths wide open as they shouted their anger. "Get along," the voice beside me said, but I couldn't move. I was frozen by what I saw and heard. Policemen stood in front of wooden sawhorse barricades, holding the people back. The rumble of the crowd was like that at a football game, when the hero runs the ball to the end zone for a touchdown. Only this time, none of the voices were cheering.
"The niggers! Keep the niggers out!"
The shouts came closer. The roar swelled, as though their frenzy had been fired up by something. It took a moment to digest the fact that it was the sight of us. Hustled along, we walked up the few concrete stairs through the heavy double doors that led inside the school, and then up a few more stairs. It was like entering a darkened movie theater amid the rush of a crowd eager to get seated before the picture begins. I was barely able to see where we were rushing to. There were blurred images all around me as we moved up more stairs.
The sounds of footsteps, ugly words, insulting shouts, and whispered commands formed an echoing clamor.
Niggers! Niggers! The niggers are in!
They were talking about me. The shouting wouldn't stop. It got louder as more joined in.
They're in here! Oh, God, the niggers are in here!
One girl shouted, running ahead of us down the hallway.
They got in! I smell something.
You niggers better turn around and go home. I was racing to keep pace with a woman who shouted orders over her shoulders to us. Nobody had yet told us she was someone we could trust, someone we should be following. I tried to move among the angry voices, blinking, struggling to accustom my eyes to the very dim light. The unfamiliar surroundings reminded me of the inside of a museum. Marble floors and stone walls and long winding hallways that seemed to go on forever. It was a huge, cavernous building, the largest I'd ever been in. Breathless, I made my legs carry me quickly past angry white faces, dodging fists that struck out at me. The principal's office is this way, whispered a petite woman with dark hair and glasses. Hurry now, hurry! I was walking as fast as I could. Then we were shoved into an office where there was more light. Directly in front of us, behind a long counter, a row of white people, mostly women, stood staring at us as though we were the world's eighth wonder. In the daylight, I recognized Mrs. Huckabee, Central High's vice principal for girls, who had been present at several of our earlier meetings with the school board.
This is Jess Matthews, the principal, she said. You remember him?
No, I didn't remember. He peered at us with an acknowledging frown and nod, then quickly walked away.
Here are your class schedules and homeroom assignments. Wait for your guides, Mrs. Huckabee said.
That's when I noticed that, just beyond the glass panels in the upper part of the door that led to the office, clusters of students stood glaring at us. One boy opened the door and walked in, yelling,
"You're not gonna let those niggers stay in here, are you?"
All at once, Thelma Mothershed slumped down on the wooden bench just inside the door of the office. Mrs. Huckabee hustled the boy out and turned her attention to Thelma, as we all did. She was pale, her lips and fingertips blue. Breathless as she was, she mustered a faint smile and tried to reassure us. None of us wanted to leave her there with those white strangers, but Mrs. Huckabee seemed to be a take-charge person who would look after her. She ushered us out, saying we had to go. Just for an instant, I worried about how Thelma's parents would get through the huge crowd outside to pick her up if she were really ill. 3:39. That was the number of the homeroom on my card. I was assigned to the third floor. We quickly compared notes. Each of us was assigned to a different homeroom.
Why can't any of us be in the same homeroom or take classes together? I asked.
From behind the long desk, a man spoke in an unkind, booming voice.
You wanted integration. You got integration.
I turned to see the hallway swallow up my friends. None of us had an opportunity to say a real goodbye or make plans to meet. I was alone, in a daze, following a muscular, stocky white woman with closely cropped straight black hair. Up the stairs I went, squeezing my way past those who first blocked my path and then shouted hurtful words at me. Frightened did not describe my state. I had moved on to terrified. My body was numb. I was only aware of my head and thoughts and visions. I had fantasized about how wonderful it would be to get inside the huge, beautiful castle I knew as Central High School. But the reality was so much bigger, darker, and more treacherous than I had imagined. I could easily get lost among its spiral staircases. The angry voices shouting at me made it all the more difficult to find my way through these unfamiliar surroundings. I was panic-stricken at the thought of losing sight of my guide.
I ran to keep up with her.
"Move it, girlie,"
she called back at me.
"Pee-you!"
one boy said, backing away from me. Others stopped and joined in his ridicule. For an instant, I stood paralyzed.
"Don't stop,"
the woman commanded. Her words snapped me into action. I scuffled to move behind her. Suddenly, I felt it. The sting of a hand slapping the side of my cheek, and then warm, slimy saliva on my face, dropping to the collar of my blouse. A woman stood toe to toe with me, not moving.
"Nigga!"
she shouted in my face again and again. She appeared to be a little older than my mother. Her face was distorted by rage.
"Nigga, bitch! Why don't you go home?"
she lashed out at me.
"Next thing you'll want to marry one of our children."
"Marry," I thought, as I darted around her. I wasn't even allowed to go on a real date. Grandma wouldn't let me marry. Besides, why would I choose to marry one of those mean Little Rock white people? My temples throbbed, my cheeks stung. The spit was still on my face. It was the first time I had ever been spat upon. I felt hurt, embarrassed. I wondered if I'd catch her germs. Before I could wipe it off, my guide's harsh command summoned me to move.
"Get going, now! Do you hear me? Move, now!"
I brushed the saliva off my nose with my hand. As I entered the classroom, a hush fell over the students. The guide pointed me to an empty seat, and I walked toward it. Students sitting nearby quickly gathered their books and moved away. I sat down, surrounded by empty seats, feeling unbearably self-conscious. Still, I was relieved to be off my feet. I was disoriented, as though my world were blurred and leaning to the left, like a photograph snapped from a twisted angle and out of focus. A middle-aged woman, whom I assumed to be the teacher, ignored me. "Open your book to page 12, she said, without allowing her eyes to acknowledge me.
"Are you gonna let that nigger coon sit in our class?"
a boy shouted as he glared at me. I waited for the teacher to say or do something.
"Now, class, if you've done the homework, then you know."
A loud voice cut her off, shouting,
"We can kick the crap out of this nigger,"
the heckler continued.
"Look, it's 20 of us and one of her. They ain't nothing but animals."
Again, I waited for the teacher to speak up, but she said nothing. Some of the students snickered. The boy took his seat, but he kept shouting ugly words at me throughout the rest of the class. My heart was weeping, but I squeezed back the tears. I squared my shoulders and tried to remember what Grandma had said. "God loves you, child. No matter what, he sees you as his precious idea." Walking the gauntlet to my next class was even more harrowing. I had to go out behind the school, through the girls' dressing room, down a long concrete walkway, and onto the playing field.
"You'd better watch yourself,"
the guide warned as we moved at high speed through the hostile students. As we went outside to the walkway in the back of the school, I could hear the roar of the crowd in front of the school. It was even more deafening than the jeers immediately around me. On the playing field, groups of girls were gathered tossing a volleyball. The teacher appeared to be a no-nonsense person. With a pleasant smile, she pointed me to a spot near the net and warned the other girls not to bother me.
"Let's keep the game going, girls,"
she said in a matter-of-fact way. The girls paused for a moment, looked at each other, looked at me, and then began tossing the ball back and forth. For just one instant, I was actually concerned about whether or not I could hit the ball and score. It took me a moment to realize it was whizzing awfully close to my head. I ducked, but they hit me real hard, shouting and cheering as they found their target. And even as I was struggling to escape their cruelty, I was at the same time more terrified by the sound of the angry crowd in the distance. It must be enormous, I thought. How would the police keep them back?
Get inside, Melba, now!
The face of the gym teacher showed both compassion and alarm as she quietly pointed to a group of women some distance away, jumping over the rear fence as they shouted obscenities at me.
Hurry!
I started to run for my life.
Nigger! Nigger!
One woman cried, hot on my heels.
Get the nigger!
Three of them had broken away from the pack and were gaining on me. I was running at top speed when someone stuck out a foot and tripped me. I fell face forward, cutting my knee and elbow. Several girls moved closer, and for an instant, I hoped they were drawing near to extend a hand and ask me if I needed help.
The nigger is down,
one shouted.
She's bleeding. What do you know? Niggers bleed red blood. Let's kick the nigger.
I saw the foot coming my way and grabbed it before it got to my face. I twisted it at the ankle like I'd seen them do at the wrestling match. The girl fell backward. As I scrambled to my feet, I looked back to see the brigade of attacking mothers within striking distance, shouting about how they weren't going to have me in school with their kids. I ran up the stairs, hoping I could find my way back to the office. With the mothers close on my heels, shouting their threats, the twisted maze of the hallway seemed even more menacing. I felt I could have gotten lost forever as I struggled to find the door that led to the office and safety, opening first one, then another. I raced through a honeycomb of locker rooms and dead-end hallways. After several minutes of opening the wrong doors and bumping into people who hit me or called me names, I was in tears, ready to give up, paralyzed by my fear. Suddenly, Grandma's voice came into my head. God never loses one of his flock. Shepherd, show me how to go, I said. I stood still and repeated those words over and over again until I gained some composure. I wiped my eyes, and then I saw blood running down my leg and onto my saddle shoe. It was too much. I pressed my thumb to the wounded area to try and stop the bleeding.
I've been looking for you.
The stocky guide's voice was angry, but I was so glad to see her. I almost forgot myself and reached to hug her.
And just where do you think you are going? You are only supposed to travel through the school with me.
She looked at my leg, but said nothing, then looked away. Yes, ma'am, but...
But nothing. Let's go to shorthand class.
She didn't know it, but she was the answer to my prayer. I was so grateful for her being there. I looked over my shoulder to see the group of mothers standing still, obviously unwilling to come after me with a school official at my side. I choked back tears and speeded my steps.
Hello, honey. Welcome. We're just beginning. I'm Mrs. Pickwick.
The warm voice of the tiny, dark-haired woman comforted me. Although she was petite, I quickly discovered that my shorthand teacher was definitely not one to tolerate any hanky-panky. When students moved away from me, hurling insults, she gave them a stern reprimand.
If you move to the office and see the principal,
she said, without so much as a hint of compromise in her voice. As I headed for the last row of empty seats by the window, she called out to me, Melba, stay away from the window. Her voice was sympathetic, as though she really cared what happened to me. As I turned back to follow her orders, I caught a glimpse of the crowd across the street from the front of the school. I was so transfixed by the sight, I couldn't move. The ocean of people stretched farther than I could see, waves of people ebbing and flowing, shoving the sawhorses and the policemen who were trying to keep them in place. There were lots of uniformed policemen, but the crowd must have outnumbered them by 100-fold. Every now and then, 3 or 4 people broke through and dashed across the street
toward the front of the school. The police would run after them.
Melba, please, take your seat.
Slowly, reluctantly, I turned away and stumbled to my seat. As I sat there, trying to focus on the shorthand book before me, I could hear some of the things the crowd was shouting.
Get the niggers! And 2, 4, 6, 8, we ain't gonna integrate!
Although I could not erase the images or the sounds of those people outside, somehow, Mrs. Pickwick was so sincere and determined to be as normal as possible that I actually listened to what she had to say about shorthand. I even managed to draw several shorthand characters on my tablet as the noise got louder and louder. I looked up from my notes to see my guide entering the door. She wore a frown and was red-faced and perspiring. Something was awfully wrong. It was written all over her face.
Come with me now, to the principal's office,
she called out nervously. This time, she collected my books and shoved them into my arms. I walked even faster than before. We were almost running.
Don't stop for anything,
she shouted at me over the noise. As I followed her through an inner office, past very official-looking white men, I was alarmed by the anxious expressions on their faces. I was led to an adjoining anteroom, a smaller office where some of the 8 had gathered. Two of the girls were crying. I stood near the door, which was ajar enough so that although I could not see who was speaking, I could hear much of the men's conversations. I heard their frantic tone of voice, heard them say the mob was out of control, that they would have to call for help.
What are we going to do about the nigger children?
Asked one.
The crowd is moving fast. They've broken down the barricades. These kids are trapped in here.
Good Lord, you're right, another voice said. We may have to let the mob have one of these kids, so as we can distract them long enough to get the others out.
11.
Let one of those kids hang? How's that gonna look? Niggers are not their children, and we got a job to do.
Hang one of us? They were talking about hanging one of my friends, or maybe even me. My knees were shaking so badly I thought I would fall over. I held my breath, trying not to make any noise. The two men discussing our fate were just on the other side of the door. I turned my back to the partially open door, at the same time moving closer to it so I could hear more. I tried to look unconcerned so as not to frighten the others. Already some of them were crying, and Thelma's face was blue. I moved even closer to hear a man's voice say,
They're children. What do? Have them draw straws to see which one gets a rope around their neck? It may be the only way out. There must be 1,000 people out there, armed and coming this way. Some of these patrolmen are throwing down their badges, another breathless voice said. We gotta get them out of here.
I heard footsteps coming closer. I moved to the center of the room, closer to where my friend stood surrounding Thelma, who sat on her haunches. A tall, raw-boned, dark-haired man came toward us. I'm Gene Smith, assistant chief of the Little Rock Police Department. He spoke in a calm tone. It's time for you to leave for today. Come with me now. Right away, I had a good feeling about him because of the way he introduced himself and took charge. He urged us to move faster, acting as though it mattered to him whether or not we got out. It's 11:30. I want you out of here before noon. Gene Smith. His was the voice I had heard in the next room, saying he would rather get all of us out than hang one to save the others. I decided to forever remember this man in my prayers. I scrambled to keep up with the others as we moved at a quick pace toward the 14th Street side of Central High. It was almost a block away, but suddenly Smith and the other men turned from the main hallway
and began descending stairs into passageways that became more and more dim.
What if they were going to kill us? I didn't really know these men, yet I had no choice but to trust them. I focused on speeding down the narrow concrete passageway, down the stairs into a dark cellar where one